Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. A few months ago on Smart Talk, we took a look at why there seemingly were more bears wandering into residential neighborhoods. At the time, Pennsylvania Game Commission biologist Mark Turnant pointed out that there is a lot of bear activity, but there is also a lot that people don't know about bears. So he is back today on today's show for a kind of a Bears 101 discussion. Mark Turnant, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you.
If you have a question or a comment about black bears in Pennsylvania, we're not going to just talk about why they're wandering into residential neighborhoods. We're going to talk about the bears themselves. Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, so when we had the discussion over the summer about bears wandering into residential neighborhoods, you said to me after the program, you know, we should do a show, we should have a discussion about what people don't know about bears, that there are a lot of myths out there. Why are there so many myths? Why do people know so little about black bears in Pennsylvania?
Well, I think until just recent years, people weren't around bears. You know, bears have expanded their range. They've put them closer to people. And there's a lot of people in Pennsylvania that 15, 20, 25 years ago didn't have bears in their area. So their understanding of bears and bear biology was based on stories that we tell our kids or folklore, things like that.
Well, and the thing is that, I mean, obviously, a black bear is a wild animal and is not something that a lot of people want to come into contact with, but and, you know, can be dangerous. But let's face it, it used to be that many people, when they thought of bears, it was like, okay, here's an animal that's going to eat me, it's going to kill me, it's going to harm me, and that's what they were afraid of bears, right?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, that mentality contributed to their population declines in the early 1900s. I mean, bears were persecuted, they were misunderstood, they were feared for livestock and safety, and so there was a lot of indiscriminate mortality, and that contributed to why we had a bottleneck in our bear population.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, when you say in the early part of the century, you're talking about the 1900s, what was the bear population at its peak in Pennsylvania?
Well, you know, we weren't doing population studies in the early 1900s, but we can look at harvest, and we know that we were harvesting about 300 bears a year in the early 1900s, and given what we know about bear populations, that meant we had about 3,000 bears.
That's it.
Yep.
Compared to 20,000 now.
And they were also isolated in our north central part of the state in the Pocono region. So we had a lot of the state that had no bears, and we had kind of a relic population in the Big Woods area.
Mm-hmm. That may surprise a lot of people that there are six times, maybe almost seven times as many bears today as there were in the early 1900s. Is the black bear native to Pennsylvania?
It is. It's the only species of bear we have in the eastern U.S. There are three species of bears in North America, but the only one we have in Pennsylvania is the American black bear.
All right. So let's get into some of the myths and learning something about black bears today. You kind of touched on this just a moment ago. But one of the myths is that bears only live in remote forests, as you mentioned, North Central, Potter, Tioga, Bradford counties, and the Pocono region, Pike County, Wayne County, those areas. And that is certainly not the case today.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at ecology books from 40 years ago, they'll tell you that black bears were a keystone species. They were only found in wilderness areas, big woods. And what we have found is that they do quite well in a lot of other places, too. We just didn't have bears in those areas, so our understanding of what habitat bears needed wasn't complete. As we've seen populations grow in the last 30 years, we've now got bears in every county in the state. About 60 counties have year-round resident bear populations. And so bears, they live much closer to people and do very well than what we originally gave them credit for.
So when you say all 67 counties, I think a lot of people think of Allegheny and Philadelphia counties. There are actually bears that have been in those two counties.
Allegheny County has resident bear population in the suburban areas, the more undeveloped rural areas in the periphery. Now, Philadelphia, we have an occasional sighting of a bear down there, but, you know, we probably don't have year-round residents in Philadelphia.
Why has that population grown so much?
Well, part of it is bears are just adaptable. They do well around people. They seem to habituate to the sounds and the sights and the presence of people quite well. Other bear species don't do that as well. And the other thing is that they're flexible in their habitat needs. They do need forested habitat, but that can be any type of forest. They don't need to have mature big woods forest. They do quite well in that agricultural forest land mix.
What do bears eat?
They eat anything, whatever happens to be in front of them. A bear spends their whole life looking for their next meal. Their biology, their adaptations, their life history, their reproductive cycle, everything is tied to where their next meal is.
Mm-hmm. So when you say anything, I mean, is there anything that they prefer?
Well, it's seasonal. So in the spring, they're eating a lot of vegetation. Late spring, it'll be insects. A lot of people don't realize bears eat a lot of ants and bees late spring, early summer. Midsummer, it'll be fruits. There's a whole list of plants out there that produce fruits in Pennsylvania. Blueberries, blackberries, huckleberries. I mean, we can go on. And then late summer, early fall, they'll switch over to hard mast, and that's acorns, hickory nuts, beech nuts in our northern counties. And so it changes seasonally, and there's a large diversity of food in their diet.
I hear no meat there, though.
They will eat meat. They occasionally might catch a small rodent or a small mammal. We do know that bears will eat deer fawns. They do that for a very narrow part of the time, right after the fawns drop. It's about a two-week window where bear predation is relatively high on fawns, but then they give it up. They're not built to chase things. They're a bit lazy. They'd rather eat what's easy to find and more abundant. So we do know they eat deer fawns, but it's not high predation rates year-round.
Okay, tell me about the bear's teeth, because, again, I think that most people think of the bear as a carnivore and think of it as a meat eater, or it could be a man eater. But from what you're describing, bear shouldn't have canine teeth, shouldn't have the teeth of a carnivore.
If you, I guess the first thing about teeth is that a lot of people don't realize they're born with milk teeth that they replace, just like you and I do. So they have
no tooth fairy, though.
No tooth fairies. Oh, okay. But the last tooth to replace is the canine tooth, and that happens at about a year old. So you can actually distinguish cubs from adults by the shape of the canine tooth. But that canine tooth is really what sets them aside as a carnivore. The rest of their teeth look like ours. They're our incisors, our molars. They have a flat crown molar meant for grinding. So their teeth look a lot like ours, except for those big canines.
Mm-hmm. So, again, meat eater is a bit of a myth.
Correct. They do have, like I said, they do have meat in their diet. It's opportunistic. They have a lot more vegetation and nuts and berries in their diet than they would meat.
Mm. But as you also said, that they will eat almost anything, and that's where they get into coming into residential areas, into garbage cans, into squirrel bird feeders, things yep. like that.
That represents calories. To you and I, it might be trash or it might be meant for the birds, but to a bear, it represents calories. So bird feeders, garbage cans, that represent over half of our nuisance bear conflicts are tied to those two things. So they having 12 million people in the bear range does contribute calories to bears, and that's one of the reasons why bears do so well in Pennsylvania, is they have excellent habitat, but they also have a lot of extra calories related to people.
Mm-hmm. So those calories, I mean, is there instinct in them that, as you said, the bear is always looking for food, but is that their instinct that I have to add some weight here? I mean, they're not consciously making that thought.
No, not necessarily. Bears do have an interesting reproductive cycle. It's called delayed implantation. So you think about most mammals, we have breeding and then fertilization and embryos develop and then birth occurs. Well, with bears, it's delayed. They breed in June and July, but it's not until late October, early November that egg will implant and begin to develop. So it's delayed. And a bear has to be about 100 to 110 pounds for that to occur. So they do spend the summer trying to gain weight so that those pregnancies will go through in the fall. If they're underweight, then those pregnancies abort and they breed again the following summer. So weight is tied to reproduction. It's not just looking for your next meal. Their ability to reproduce is tied to their weight.
Do bear have, are there alpha bears? I mean, with the males and females too, I mean, there aren't harems like a lot of other species.
Nope,
But who does the breeding here?
Well,
how do they do it?
Bears are generally solitary, unless they're with young or during the breeding season. They're solitary animals. So the males are by themselves, the females are by themselves, or with young maybe. Both sexes are polygamous. A lot of people don't realize. They know that males are breeding with multiple females, but females also breed with multiple males. There's been some genetic work done that indicates that in a litter of three cubs, two might be sired by one male and the third by another. So there's a lot of polygamous activity in both sexes. They're only together during the breeding season, and then they're solitary.
Hmm. A couple of questions from listeners. Derek asked, when we come across a pile of feces in the woods or our yard, other than the size of the pile, what are some ways to identify if it is bear or another critter?
Well, you can look at content. A lot of times it'll be seeds, depending on the time of year. If it's in the summer when they're eating fruits, you'll see a lot of seed residue in the scat. In the spring, you'll see pieces of vegetation. And so that's you use size and content to kind of distinguish it from other animals out there. Raccoon might be the closest thing that would have a similar content, but they're much smaller.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I hate to ask this question, but size. I mean, how big is a pile from a bear?
Well, it fit in both hands. It's fairly big.
Really?
Yep.
Okay. Paul says, I know, and this is one of the questions I know many people have because of coming into contact with bears. I know it goes without saying you should never come between a mother bear and her cubs. But seriously, though, what should you do if you come on unintentionally, find yourself between a mother bear and her cubs? Run, hide, climb a tree.
Well, actually, the first thing you do is let the bear know you're there. Make a little noise, cough, talk. A lot of times, the bear won't know you're there. And what you want to avoid is suddenly surprising that bear when it's too close. So make some noise, let the bear know you're there. And a lot of times the sighting is over at that point. The bear takes off. And then start backing up. Give yourself a little space. Let the bear know you're there. Back up. Give it some space. And if the bear does approach you or act aggressive, then stand your ground and try to intimidate it. Wave your arms, yell. But generally, just letting the bear know you're there and backing up is all you need to do.
Running, climbing a tree, not a good idea?
No, the three don'ts are don't run, don't turn your back, don't climb a tree. You can't outrun a bear, you can't outclimb a bear, and you always want to know what the bear's doing so you don't turn your back.
See, that sounds like it would be hard to do, to stand your ground. And, okay, back up with this one thing, but not because a lot of humans, their first instinct out of fear is, okay, I'm taking off here.
Yeah, I tell people to treat a bear like you would a stray dog in your yard. You know, you're not going to let it stay there. You're going to yell at it. You're going to wave your arms. You want it to move on, but you're going to keep your eye on it, and you're going to back up. So just because it's a bear, they are relatively easy to intimidate. If you wave your arms and yell, make some noise, most bears will respond to that and leave.
Mm. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. WITF, in partnership with State Impact Pennsylvania, will host a local retro report discussion from invasive species to the TMI shutdown. Some of Pennsylvania's top environmental headlines have roots in historical events. Join me Wednesday, October 23rd, a week from tomorrow, from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the WITF Public Media Center as I host a retro report screening and panel discussion. We'll talk about climate change, invasive species, water quality, and more. Register to attend at WITF.org/events. And don't miss Retro Report. It premiered last week. It's Monday and Tuesdays at 9 p.m. on WITF-TV. New episodes air on Monday and Tuesdays through October 29th. And it's a great show. So I encourage everyone to get a look at Retro Report. During the portion of today's program, first portion of today's program, we're talking about some myths about black bears in Pennsylvania. Most of the talk over the last few years has been that many people are coming into contact with black bears that they haven't in the past, wondering why, but there's also a lot of myths surrounding black bears, a lot that many people don't know. Our guest today is Pennsylvania Game Commission biologist Mark Tornent, and he knows everything about bears and will answer your questions. Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Mark, as we're talking about myths about black bears and what people don't know about them, what's the biggest myth, or what do you hear most often that people don't know about bears?
I think most people are surprised by hibernation. They think of a hibernator as a groundhog, you know, an animal that's asleep all winter long. But the reality is bears are quite awake. A female bear that's pregnant might be in hibernation for 5 months. And during that time, she's awake. She's able to flee the den. She's able to defend the den. She'll give birth to cubs during that time. And so there's the bears, if you walk up to a hibernating bear, it'll wake up, it'll lift its head and look up at you. If you get too close, it'll get up and run away. So that's one thing I think people are surprised of. The other thing is that they den a lot of times on top of the ground. A lot of people picture a bear going in and out of the cave. But the reality is that we have maybe less than a quarter of the dens we examine are actually in rock cavities. Most of them are on top of the ground. They look like a big bird's nest. And imagine giving birth to 3 newborn cubs in the middle of January in a den like that and having high cub survival. That, I think that surprises a lot of people.
Those nests, what are they made of?
Usually it's twigs. They'll go into a thicket, break off the branches, and build what looks like a big bird's nest. It might be 3 foot across, 1.5 feet deep, and the bear will lay in that nest all winter long, awake, nursing the cubs, grooming the cubs every day. And so it's not what we typically think of as a hibernator.
Yeah, probably many people think of a bear in hibernation as sleeping the entire time. And as you're describing, there are many times where they're awake. What about feeding? What about food?
They don't eat, they don't drink, and they don't produce any waste. So imagine spending 5 months without eating or without drinking, and yet they only lose about 30% of their body weight. So they do fairly well. They conserve energy, but with a low metabolic rate. But they are awake and aware of what's going on.
So that's the reason that they need the calories, is they're building up that fat, I would assume, to keep themselves warm, or, you know, to stay healthy while they're hibernating.
Well, their thick winter coat keeps them warm. In fact, when we're doing research in the wintertime and we're approaching these dens, it's not uncommon to find snow on top of the bear with it laying there on top of the ground if it's been a fresh snow. So their fur keeps them insulated, but their fat reserves help them get through the winter metabolically.
Mm-hmm. Something else you said that probably would surprise a lot of people is that they are not in caves often. They're not in dens often, but on top of the ground in a nest. Where do we get this picture of a bear going into a cave and staying there for 3 or 4 months?
Well, I think we owe that to the cartoons. You know, we see the
Yogi Bear?
Oh, Yogi Bear or Larson cartoons. You know, you see the bear going in and out of a cave. And that's what we picture a den is, but it's not. It's a much simpler design than a cave.
Mm. Another myth, that bears only have 1 or 2 cubs at a time.
The average in Pennsylvania is 3. In fact, we are close to the top in the nation in terms of average litter size. A lot of places have smaller litters than what we do here in Pennsylvania. And what surprises a lot of people is that close to 20% of the litters out there actually have 4 cubs. Around 3 to 5% will have 5 cubs. So our bears are very productive here in Pennsylvania, and 3 is actually the average.
Now, why would they be any more productive here than other places?
It ties back to food. You know, we talked earlier about food, and there's a lot of different types of food available in Pennsylvania. So even if it's a bad acorn year or a bad blueberry year, there's still something to eat. That's not always the case in other states that have shorter growing seasons, drier climates, less diversity of food. So bears in Pennsylvania have it pretty good, and they have some years that are better than others, but they never have a terrible year.
Well, see, this kind of goes back to one of my original questions about why the population has grown so much from 3,000 in the 1900s, early 1900s, to about 20,000 today. That, I mean, how the habitat has changed. We hear so much about development. Obviously, things have grown a whole lot over the past 120 years here in Pennsylvania, but yet the population continues to grow. There are more cubs in a litter than in other states. They kind of goes against each other.
Well, you know, there's 2 things going for bears. They're very productive in Pennsylvania, high average litter size, they breed at an early age in Pennsylvania. And the other thing is that we have a strong management program. We limit mortality. We have the bear hunting season is very restrictive, and so we limit mortality. We have high productivity, and that results in a wildlife success story. We went from 3,000 bears to 20,000 bears, and it's something we're proud of.
Is hunting the only way to manage the number of bears in the state?
There are very few things a bear dies from naturally in the woods. Old age. In fact, the oldest bear we knew of in Pennsylvania was close to 37 years old.
Really?
So in the absence of hunting, there is very little mortality other than old age. And if you want to control a bear population, hunting is really the best tool.
How do you know how old a bear is? Teeth?
Their teeth have a pattern of rings in them, microscopic rings, just like a tree has rings. If you look at a stump of a tree, you can tell how old the tree is by counting the rings. We do the same with bear teeth.
The oldest was 37. What's the average that a bear lives to here in Pennsylvania?
We regularly see bears in their early teens. Males probably have a shorter lifespan than females because they take greater risks. Yeah. They get themselves in trouble more. But the older bears tend to be the females and into their early teens, certainly.
Mm. Okay, so let's talk about size. Largest bear ever here in Pennsylvania.
876 pounds. You know, we weigh every bear in the hunting season at check stations. We weigh a lot of the bears that we capture for research work. And so we have a lot of weights in our databases, and the largest was 876.
Now, is that the one that is at Game Commission headquarters?
No, that particular bear we did not get a weight on. That was an illegally harvested bear, and by the time we caught up to the bear, it had already been processed, and so we couldn't do an actual weight on it. But the 876 was a harvested bear back in 2010, I believe.
All right, so that's recent. Where was that bear killed?
In the Pocono region of the state.
876 pounds.
Yeah. But that's not the largest one. The largest bear ever weighed in black bear in North America came from North Carolina, and they beat us by about 10 pounds.
So give me, I'm trying to get some context here, an 876-pound black bear compared to, say, a grizzly bear that we see in the western part of the United States.
Our bears would be larger most times, most cases. A bear in Yellowstone, for example, or a bear in Montana, their life's a little harder than our bears. You know, they have a shorter growing season. They have less food available to them. They have to work harder for the food they get. And so we actually get black bears in Pennsylvania that are larger than a lot of inland grizzly bears.
I have a question from Robert who asks, how do they hold the embryo for delayed implantation?
It floats in a free state in the uterus. So it's fertilized. It divides a few times. And then it reaches what's called a blastula stage, and then it floats at a free state in the uterus until it implants late in the fall.
Hmm. Another myth, and I've heard this many times, and people repeating it, that bears are asleep when the cubs are born.
No, incorrect. They're actually awake. If you've ever watched puppies being born, you know what the process is like. It looks the same in a bear den. And so the female bear, the mother, will groom those cubs immediately. She'll clean up the nest, and she will encourage them to start to nurse. So she is awake. She's aware of what's happening, and she's actually providing care daily to those cubs.
When you say groom the cubs, what do you mean by groom the cubs?
Lick them. You know, she'll lick them off, clean them. She'll do that every day.
Mm-hmm. Even though the cubs... Now, I'm trying to get a picture of when the cubs are born. Obviously, the cubs need fed pretty quickly. What kind of food does the mother provide for the cubs? How are the cubs taught how to become a bear?
Well, first, we talk about how big they are. They only weigh 8 ounces at birth, though less than half a pound, right around a half pound. They'll fit in the palm of your hand. Their eyes are closed. They have a very fine coat of hair and undeveloped ears. So they're totally dependent on the mother for care. Now, if you take a newborn cub and put it in a cardboard box and put a light bulb at one end of the box, it will crawl towards the light. It recognizes heat. So they, if you look at the thermal scan of a female bear in a den, her mammaries are where the warmest spot on her. So those cubs are able to migrate to the nipples and are able to find them even in a den. So that helps them get food immediately, and then the mother provides care daily to the cubs.
Mm-hmm. Another question Allison asked, what is the benefit to having bears in the ecosystem of Pennsylvania?
Well, there's the what comes up regularly is that they're good seed dispersers. If you look at if you ever kicked a pile of bear scat, you'll see it's full of seeds. They have large home ranges, and so they are very good for seed dispersal. They're also probably involved with, as a top carnivore, probably in a more natural ecosystem, would be involved with regulating other animal populations because they're a large carnivore.
Mm-hmm. Anne asked a question, very good question. Audubon Society recently said that we will lose the ruffed grouse as a natural resident in Pennsylvania due to climate change. Is climate change expected to impact the bear population?
Well, it will indirectly if it impacts habitat. Bears are doing well in Pennsylvania because they have a high diversity of foods and they have a high diversity habitat available to them. They may also be affected some by length of hibernation. If they enter dens later and come out of dens earlier due to climate change, that could have a negative impact on their biology. But for the most part, I think they're more adaptable to climate change than a lot of other species.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen any of that yet, where you're talking about the length of hibernation or anything, any changes there?
We have not detected it in Pennsylvania, but there are some scientific publications that report it. For example, in Europe, some of the brown bear populations in Europe have seen earlier denning and later, or earlier emergence, later denning, tied to changes in temperature in the wintertime.
Mm. Another myth, that bears den together, that there's a family. Okay, there may be a family, but that there are a bunch of bears in there.
Nope. The only time we see bears den together would be mothers with young. So the males are off denning by themselves. The females are denning by themselves unless they have young with them. Now, they will den with their year-old cubs. So a female bear only produces cubs every other year. So in years when the cubs are born, they have newborn cubs, and then they'll keep those cubs a year later and den together as yearlings.
Mm. How long do the cubs stick around the mother?
They spend 18 months with their mother. So they breed in June and July, and they will disperse the following year and a half out in the spring.
Mm-hmm. So when does a cub know it's time to go?
Well, they're kind of like people. They'll hang around as long as they can. In fact, the mother has to drive the yearlings off in order to get them to leave. The life is good for a yearling when your mother's taking care of you. So they're reluctant to leave, and the mother actually has to chase them off right before the breeding season, a year and a half after they've been born.
Now, how does a mother chase off her cubs?
She can get pretty mean. You know, I've had opportunity to see it a few times in the woods, and they will actually become aggressive, chase the yearlings away, slap them around a bit, and they're trying to get them to disperse before the breeding season kicks in.
Now, you actually, as a biologist, you're one of those people who have reached into some of the dens that may be in caves or in, you know, rock between rocks and things like that, seen them on the ground. Many people would think that's not a good idea, but how do you do that without being harmed?
Well, we got to give a lot of credit to the bear. The only reason we can get close enough to dart a bear that's in a den is because they're caring for their cubs or they're reluctant to run. So we get close enough. We use a dart pistol to put a dart in the bear. The medication takes effect in a few minutes. They fall asleep, and then we can handle them. So the bears are reluctant to leave, and that lets us get close. And it's like any other job. If you do it right, you'll be fine. And if you do it wrong, you'll be in trouble.
Yeah, that may be like any other job, but it's not like a whole lot of other jobs, Mark, I have to say. Hey, interesting, fascinating conversation today. Pennsylvania Game Commission biologist Mark Ternent. Mark, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamont. Listen, tomorrow for Smart Talk, a local perspective on Syria and a big event coming up for the Central PA Youth Ballet. Also, visit our website to get an outlook of conversations we're working on. You can leave a voicemail or voice memo question for one of our upcoming programs. More information is at WITF.org/smarttalk. 1969 was a momentous year in American history. Last July, the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing was celebrated across the nation, but it wasn't the only significant event that year. In his new book, 100 Days, How Four Events in 1969 Shaped America, cultural historian Harlan Lebo writes about the space program, the Manson murders, the Woodstock Music Festival, and the birth of the Internet. We're joined by Harlan Lebo. Mr. Lebo, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's Harlan, and thank you, Scott. Good to talk to you.
If you have a question or a comment about 1969, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Harlan, why did you want to write this book?
Well, it just struck me as an amazing coincidence that four completely unrelated events that were so profound and touched us all in the American experience, all occurred within a 100-day period. In fact, the first three of them all occurred within a month, which is a pretty amazing. So it wasn't intended to attach those four events together or link them, but just to take a look at these four, all of them very important, and they've all shaped American life ever since. And that's really what the book is about. It's not so much about the events themselves. Plenty of other people have written about those events. But it's much more about how we got to each of those events and where we have been since and where we are now.
And one of the things that I noticed reading the book that makes it unique is that you don't just write about, for example, July 20th, 1969. There was so much emphasis this summer on the 50th anniversary on July 20th when Neil Armstrong took man's first step on the moon. But you write about the backstories, the history leading up to these events. And those background stories provide some valuable context when the reader can learn more than what they normally would. And from what you're saying, that was done on purpose, that a lot of people don't know the backstories or know the history, know the context of these four events.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in, well, the whole point of the book was to encourage people to learn more about these things. If I've done my job right, people would look at this book and say, wow, those were four amazing parts of American life, and I want to learn more about them. And the backstory, especially about the space program, is truly incredible. The fact that we developed a program that put people on the moon within, well, really 8 years of when it was started is just astonishing, especially because of the technology of the time.
Now, you do talk a lot about those 8 years, but I want to start with Apollo 11. You write about how the United States, that science was not something that the people in this country excelled at, but were encouraged from the time of the Roosevelt administration, Franklin Roosevelt administration, on. And then there was von Braun, the Nazi rocket scientist that was given a pass to come up with rockets here in the U.S. after World War II. I mean, these are both fascinating parts of this whole thing. Why were they so important?
Well, they were important because on the first part of that, about the United States not being a scientific giant the way other countries were, there was plenty of science in the United States, but it just wasn't basic discovery science. The United States was an industrial powerhouse for almost 200 years, and we had resources. We had, you know, making steel and having incredible agriculture production. But in terms of basic discovery, looking at the basic parts of science and engineering and mathematics, those were much more the realms of German, English, French, Italian universities and other research organizations. And it really wasn't until after World War II that part of the United States educational system really geared up to start creating research, basic discoveries, what we call basic research these days, in a whole variety of fields. That really began to happen. And that was all very much a phenomena of after World War II.
But one of the seminal events that spurred the United States and our space program was Sputnik. When the Soviet Union put Sputnik into space in the late 1950s, to say it was a wake-up call for the United States seems to be a bit of an understatement. Talk about how significant that was in changing the thinking, the goals in this country.
It was an understatement to say it was a shock. I don't think people were as terrified as some historians would like to say, but when the Soviet Union, quite unexpected to most Americans, in October of 1957, put the first a man-made object, not only in space, but in orbit, and orbiting directly over our heads. And, of course, the natural conclusion from that is if they can put a benign satellite over our heads, they could also put rockets, missiles, and bombs over our heads as well. And that was a surprise to many Americans. Mm. And it was a wake-up call.
But a wake-up call that how did the country respond to it? I mean, you listed so many ways in which this country, from the political leaders to the education system, how did the country respond to it?
Well, it responded in many ways. First of all, we already did have an active space program, but it was kicked up. It was kicked up many notches to make it move ahead much faster than it had been before. The intention of the Eisenhower administration was to have the best spacecraft in space, and they hadn't even considered the idea of how important it was to be first. So we moved things ahead. Education programs, there were substantial billions of dollars in federal money that was injected into education at all levels. NASA was formed to bring together all of the various competitor space agencies in the military. So after October of 1957 really did signify, in its own way, it was its own Pearl Harbor, where we finally realized that we needed to move ahead, and we did.
As you write, the U.S. had more failures at first than successes, but eventually satellites put in space, then came Mercury and manned space missions. Now, everyone, and we heard so many times this summer about President Kennedy talking about the goal of sending a man to the moon by the end of the decade. Was the moon always the goal?
Well, for Kennedy it was, and he felt very strongly that one of the ways to demonstrate the United States' supremacy as a global power, especially in competition with the Soviet Union, was to demonstrate our prowess in space and in sending astronauts to the moon. But before Kennedy, no, there was no grand plan to put astronauts on the moon. As far as we'd gone when the Mercury program was announced, even before Kennedy, was we might have a program that would go around the moon and put people circling around the moon. But the idea of landing on the moon was considered much too challenging. Kennedy did not think the idea of putting people around the moon would be politically or emotionally or scientifically satisfying to anyone. So he revved that up considerably in May of 1961 when he launched the challenge to the nation that we, before the decade was out, that we would put men on the moon and then return them safely to Earth.
Much was written and said during the 50th anniversary of the Apollo moon landing. What don't most people know?
Well, I think it's impossible almost to overestimate the complication of the mission and the number of unknowns when we began this in 1961. Remember, we had an active space program. We had men in space, at least one man in space, when Kennedy made this announcement. But I think what most people don't understand is how incredibly complicated and challenging the idea of putting live people into orbit and then across space and land them on the moon and return them, especially in the absence of most major computers as we have now. Your cell phone has much more computing power than an entire floor of computers at NASA that ran Apollo. And the complications of putting a gigantic rocket into orbit and getting the astronauts into space was truly the most incredible thing we could ever imagine. The single most complicated mechanical device ever created, and it worked.
I want to move on to the Manson murders. Actress Sharon Tate and four others were brutally murdered in Tate's home August 9th. The next night, Rosemary and Lino LaBianca in Los Angeles. The killings were ordered by Charles Manson as a way to start a race war that he called Helter Skelter after a Beatles song. But tell us about Manson. You write extensively about his background. He was not the hippie guru that many people pictured him as, was he?
No, he was portrayed that way, and I think when he was arrested and wound up on the cover of Life magazine in December of 1969, Charles Manson and his followers were presented as the love and peace generation gone wrong. But Charles Manson was no hippie. He was not part of the counterculture. He represented none of the peace and love values that an entire young generation of people was representing in 1967 in the Summer of Love in San Francisco, or just the general counterculture of the 1960s. Charles Manson was a chronic criminal. He'd spent more than half his life in jail. When he got out in 1968, he was on parole. He decided to go to San Francisco, and he became a hunter. He was hunting for followers, hunting for women to sleep with. And what eventually evolved was a group that lived around him that he plied with drugs and with his own philosophy, and they became literally the Manson family.
How could Manson manipulate people and get people, and most of these kids were from middle-class homes, how could Manson get his followers to kill for him?
Well, that's one of the tragedies of the 60s, is that in addition to the love and peace movement, what that did, and there were tremendous divisions among generations in the 1960s, which really began in the 1950s, but it burst forth full in the 1960s, and there were many lonely, disenfranchised, runaways, people, kids thrown out of their homes, and they were vulnerable, and they were looking for love and attention and people, someone who could understand them. And Charles Manson recruited, he hunted, literally hunted, young people, mostly women, who he could build a family from, who he professed to show how much he understood them. Combine that with lots of drugs, in particular psychedelic drugs like LSD, the mind becomes very pliable on psychedelics. And through that combination of his own brand of charisma and philosophy combined with drugs, produced a small core group that was willing to do anything for him. It wasn't just the fact they would go and kill, but they would do anything for him.
These murders were different. You write that we don't remember the name of the guy who killed dozens in Las Vegas 2 years ago, which is absolutely true. But 50 years later, Manson, even though he's dead, still has followers. Why?
I think that is the big issue to remember about Charles Manson is he is remembered when many other much more brutal murderers are forgotten. Their crimes may not be forgotten, but they are. Charles Manson had a political philosophy and a viewpoint and a way of attracting the media that was irresistible for the 50 years or 49 years he lived after the murders. That political voice he had resonated for years. And when and he just became a representative, the elder statesman of the dark side of American life in many ways.
About a week after the Manson murders, Woodstock, the music festival in New York, which I didn't realize, by the way, was only 15 miles from the Pennsylvania border. Why was Woodstock so significant?
Yes, as I'm reminded by my friends from New York City, everything north of New York City is upstate New York.
I know. I was about to say that, too.
it's true that here we are a week after the Manson murders, and of course no one knew it was Manson at that point. They just knew that there were these two nights of horrific murders in Los Angeles, followed the following week by an event that could have been an absolute disaster, putting hundreds of thousands of young people in the middle of nowhere with very little food, no sanitation, no water, and endless traffic. And what it turned out to be was a miracle, where it became the standard for how young people or anyone in this country truly could get along in the worst of circumstances. And it became the Woodstock generation. It defined itself just by existing, and Woodstock, the Woodstock generation, or the Woodstock anything, has become known as something truly wonderful. So when Barack Obama was, his second inauguration was called the Washington Woodstock. And people know what that means, and that's what it became.
I will say this, is just as an aside and a personal opinion, the music in 1969 was the best that we've ever had. Anyway, that's just as an aside. But what you just touched on is one of the most striking aspects of Woodstock, and it wasn't always portrayed this way in the media, but was the cooperation, the compassion, the kindness that people showed at Woodstock.
Yeah, there was, and not just within the people who were there, but in the community as well. The community was not particularly in favor of it. It had already been turned down in several other places, but a local farmer named Max Yasger allowed his land to be used for it. But once it was there, and once the people were there, everyone pitched in to support the 400,000 people who were there with food. The Army chipped in with helicopters and doctors. A whole fleet of doctors from New York City came in. And that really did celebrate the tone of the whole event, where the people who were there, they shared what they had, they enjoyed what they had, they just became literally a giant family.
You write in the book that so many people at Woodstock said they were changed by the experience. How?
I think they for the first time in their lives, really understood that life could be the way they imagined it could be, where they could have love and peace in their lives and true cooperation between friendships and live as a family. Mm. Not that people all wanted to join a commune of 400,000, but to realize that all their best expectations about life could occur, the kind of life that was different than the one that they didn't like that their parents had, was possible. And even if it didn't become exactly that for them in their lives, they were shaped by that thought. And the six people who were all participants that I interviewed for the book still feel that way today. In fact, several of them are volunteers at Woodstock or live nearby because of that.
We have a phone call. Alan is in outside of Harrisburg, was at Woodstock all 3 days. Alan, I have to ask you to be paired up pretty quick because I'm running out of time.
Yes. Me and my twin brother attended Woodstock all 3 days. When we got there, we separated paths, and his experiences and what he got involved with while he was there was different than mine. I made it a point to stay in front of the stage the whole time and watch all the performers. And I also made the decision to not use drugs, because as I stood up and looked around and saw the mass of people there, I wanted to remember my whole experience. And so when I meet others who attended Woodstock, more often than not, I can tell them things about what happened, about the performers, different events that took place in this, the whole situation, than they can tell me. Usually they just tell me they had a great time because they were, I don't know, swimming naked or something, you know. But the point is, I made it a point to not use drugs for that purpose, because I realized to myself as I looked around and experienced what you were just talking about, that this was something I wanted to remember and have a good conscious thought and connection with all of what was happening, as well as the performers and things that I noticed and I could recall and talk in terms of different unique things that I observed about the performers, many of whom, of course, were all new to
right.
me as well.
Hey, Alan, I have to run. Thank you very much for your call. But Harlan, he with 400,000 people there, so many people had different experiences. But there were others who weren't on drugs or swimming nude and all that. I only have a few minutes left, so I do want to move on to the birth of the Internet. And no, it was not Al Gore who invented the Internet. Take us to UCLA in Los Angeles in 1969.
Well, I think that's the briefest part of that. The Internet we know is nothing at all like what it was for probably 20 years at least. But in 1969, on October 29th, 1969, a graduate student at UCLA and a staff member at the Stanford Research Institute finally were able to connect computers in a way that ultimately created the technology that led to the Internet as we know it today.
Like in
so
what way?
As much as anything. I'm sorry?
In what way? How were they able to connect those computers?
They used a system called packet switching, which sends bits and pieces of information that could be scattered all over the world and then come back together. So if I send you an email, it might go directly to you, or it could break up into little pieces. But because it's all numbered and identified, it eventually pulls itself back together before it reaches you. And that phenomena is now used. It's still the basis of what the Internet is today. And that experiment, which of course no one knew at the time what it really was, or the importance it would be for everyone, led to the Internet. And it evolved very gradually and became a tool that academics and government agencies used for more than 20 years before people really started to appreciate that it had a role for the public to use, first in email and then as a search in search engines. And eventually we got around to web browsers like Mosaic, which became Netscape, and that's when it really began to become a more popular phenomenon.
Yeah, there are so many things when you write about the birth of the Internet that it's just so fascinating how some of the things that how they came about, the names they got that we still use today. We only have about 30 seconds left, and I hate to restrict you to that, but what's the takeaway from 1969 and your book?
I think the takeaway is that there are all of these events, and it's not just the four events that I was talking about, but our experience as a country has been shaped by the four that I talk about in many ways, about violence, about counterculture and the way the counterculture is now part of the mainstream, and about this amazing technology that we have that we can use or abuse to our own benefit or our own consequence. And those are all things that affect us today, and they're all all grew out of 1969.
Harlan Lebo, author of the book 100 Days, How Four Events in 1969 Shaped America, a fascinating read. Mr. Lebo, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Scott. Glad to be here.
Coming up on tomorrow's show, we're talking about the Central Pennsylvania Ballet, coming up tomorrow, and also a local perspective on Syria.